Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, it's the Wealth and Stealth Tax Autumn Statement Special. What was announced by the Chancellor, and will it get the nation's finances under control? The good news then, the energy price guarantee has been extended, minimum wage increased, the pensions triple lock continues, plus extra money for schools, the NHS and social care in England. The bad news comes for those on higher incomes, pay themselves in dividends, drive electric cars, home buyers, and those who want to leave something to their loved ones when they die. We delve into the details and how it will impact you. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, families face real challenges, warned the Chancellor as he delivered his autumn statement this week. Government forecasters are predicting the biggest drop in living standards since records began. The Office for Budget Responsibility says household income will fall by 7% over the next 18 months due to soaring inflation. In response, we got tax rises and a spending squeeze. The Resolution Foundation says it piles further pressure on the squeezed middle earners. Labour, meanwhile, well, they reckon it's an invoice for the economic carnage created by the policies of former Prime Minister Liz Truss. So what was in there? And will it work? Firstly, Simon, how bad is the economic situation we find ourselves in? Into what context was this statement delivered?
The context that the statement was delivered in seems pretty astonishing, considering the fact that until a few months ago, Rishi Sunak, who is now the Prime Minister, was the Chancellor. And as far as we were concerned, we were suffering an inflation shock, but all was pretty much okay. We then had Jeremy Hunt stand up this week, and he delivered what I would describe as something very much akin to the tax part of Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto, but without any of the benefit of the spending that was going to come with that from Corbyn. So it was pretty miserable. If you think about what Jeremy Hunt did in terms of the stealth tax, in terms of bringing the 45p tax rate down to £125,000, which is really largely a gesture more than anything else. Again, something Jeremy Corbyn wanted to do. And the way that he slashed capital gains tax and dividend allowances and many other things, then yes, it looks very much akin to that manifesto that was put out in the election that Boris Johnson won. And then, of course, Boris Johnson's chancellor was Rishi Sunak. So what's gone wrong here is reasonable to ask. Well, we had this fiscal black hole, the supposed £55 billion fiscal black hole, or it might be £58 billion, or it might be £60 billion. At one point, it seemed to have gone up to £70 billion last week, and some people had put it at £50 billion. Anyway, there was this black hole. What is this black hole? What did it relate to? Well, what it relates to is the fiscal rules that Rishi Sunak brought in when he was Chancellor. He announced them this time last year, pretty much. And then they officially came in the March budget. Now, when the OBR did a projection along with the March budget, it said that Rishi had, and the nation had, about a £30 billion margin to hit these targets. So he's gone from a £30 billion margin to a black hole twice as big. What were the targets? The fiscal rules, Sunak stated to Parliament, would apply over a three-year time horizon, and they were, I'm quoting here, underlying public sector net debt, excluding the impact of the Bank of England, must, as a percentage of GDP, be falling. And second, in normal times, the state should only borrow to invest in our future growth and prosperity. So we need to start getting the cost of our debt down, and our debt down, and we should only be borrowing for things that are going to deliver some form of future growth, rather than just borrowing to make the day-to-day books, month-to-month, year-to-year books balance. What's happened, of course, is the inflation spike has been much worse than anybody expected. The war in Ukraine Russia invading Ukraine has sent energy prices spiraling. They were already up a lot a year ago, but they've absolutely spiraled, sent food prices spiraling, sent the price of various other things spiraling. We've got the after effects, obviously, of COVID and the lockdowns causing all these problems, and inflation has gone way higher than people thought. So we're at 11% inflation. The Bank of England has had to raise interest rates much higher than everybody thought. So if you go to the point there, we were already in a worse position before the mini budget was delivered. We then had the mini budget in which Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss went all out for growth with lots of tax cuts that have been described as unfunded. If a tax cut's unfunded, basically it means it's debt funded. And the idea was that we were going to cut taxes in order to increase future growth. Now, there was a couple of problems with that. One, it didn't come with an OBR forecast and the usual OBR document. Two, it was felt like it went far too far in one go and they lacked credibility. And three, it triggered a sell-off in UK gilts, because if we were going to fund this by issuing lots of extra debt, the markets decided they didn't want the debt at the rate that we were offering, and they were going to want much higher rates on said debt, particularly with those people in charge. And then we saw this vicious circle from the pension fund sell-off. So that drove up the cost of servicing our debt as well. Now, I spoke to Carl Emerson of the Institute for Fiscal Studies about this earlier this week to try to understand what this black hole was. I thought it'd be a good idea going into the budget that we had been very much forewarned was going to be extremely painful if we knew why it was going to be so painful. So he said that basically after Kwasi Kwarteng had delivered his mini budget, the IFS looked at this on the 11th of October. That was the week that Kwasi was sacked on the Friday, as we were recording this podcast, actually. So it was before he was sacked. And at that point, the OBR looked at the situation. We had seen a couple of things happen. We'd seen the spending go up. We'd seen the emergency help on energy bills. That was going to be very, very costly and was going to last for 2 years. We'd seen gilt yields go up. So we'd seen the cost of the debt go up and all these other things. So a report in the FT this week said that basically our forecast budget deficit of about 31.6 billion in 2026, 2027 can now be almost 100 billion. This is what they thought the OBR was going to say, with about half the rise accounted for by higher interest on the UK's debt pile. So, but what Carl said is that meant that on this 11th of October date, we were looking at being about 60 billion pounds out. That's where this 55 to 60 billion figure comes from, the fiscal black hole. But since then, we had seen most of those measures reversed, all the tax cuts except for national insurance and stamp duty, and that we might now only be about 30 billion out. So why did Jeremy Hunt need to go so far? I'm sorry, I've gone around the houses to get to this point. And the answer to that is because he wants to leave himself a reasonable amount of headroom. The forecasts could be overly pessimistic, but the forecasts could also be overly optimistic. So having said that he is going to meet his new fiscal rules, which basically were the same as the old ones, but pushed it 2 years further on to make it even easier to try to hit it. Because even with all of this, he wouldn't have hit Rishi's. He also wants some wriggle room there. The other thing is we're 2 years away from an election. So having softened everybody up, as we spoke about on the podcast last week, for almost every tax to go up for this massive tax raid, the idea is, politically speaking, you hit everybody with it now. You kitchen sink it, okay? Get all the bad news out the way. And then maybe, just maybe, if things are better than expected, you might be able to reverse some of that stuff just before the election, a little bit of a giveaway. You might be able to make things seem a little bit better. I would say that I think that might be
a highly ambitious
strategy, because I don't think that this government has a hope in hell of convincing the population that even with a couple of giveaways in 2 years' time, that everything is rosy and it should be trusted with some more time in power. I genuinely don't know what would need to happen in the next 2 years. Is that all of these forecasts are way, way, way too pessimistic. And somehow, just somehow, even though he's hiking taxes into a recession, and I think causing some serious problems in the sort of tax social contract, which I'll talk about in a bit, and the Bank of England is raising interest rates, and mortgage rates are soaring through the roof, and energy bills are going up, and all of these other things. Even despite all of that, these forecasts turn out to be way too pessimistic, and actually stuff's okay. The economy is much more resilient than we think. We managed to plow our way through it, and it's nowhere near as painful as we think. Maybe, just maybe then, a few sort of giveaways with the pain front loaded now, and then a little bit of better stuff in just under 2 years' time might work. But I think there's a big if in that.
It's also a dangerous strategy, I would suggest. Like, I want to get your views, your overall views as to whether it will work a little bit later on, but I want to delve into some of the measures. And I always think it's probably better to start with some of the, dare I say, good news that's come out of it. Triple lock stays for now. Benefits will rise with inflation. We got that news as well. There was some more support for households. The extension of the energy price guarantee, though at 3,000, not 2,500 for 12 months. Minimum wage to rise. I don't know if it's good news, but windfall tax on oil and gas firms will increase until 2028. Delve into some of those for me, will you, Simon? What sticks out for you?
Well, I think, firstly, let's take the triple lock. There'd been an awful lot of debate as to whether the government was going to stick by its promise with the triple lock. The triple lock raises the state pension by the greater of three things. Inflation, average wage growth, or 2.5%. Inflation is running so hot in the measurement month of September, it was 10.1%, that the other two were well and truly eclipsed. So was the government going to deliver the triple lock, especially after welching on it last year? First, there was lots of rumours. Then Liz Truss said they were definitely sticking by it. Then she was gone. Then Jeremy Hunt was there. Then he was going to cut everything. Were they going to stick by it? He stood up and he said he was going to stick by it. Now, this means that pensions are going up by inflation. Most people's wages aren't going up by inflation. So there is definitely a bit of an issue here between workers and pensioners. But if you take workers, they have the ability to earn more money, build their wealth. I mean, it's hard to earn more money. But they are at a stage in life generally.
That's
where
the theory,
there is the opportunity there. For pensioners, there's less of the opportunity. If you're a poor pensioner, it's very likely that you are far more reliant on your state pension than if you are a wealthy pensioner. It's not that much money. This rise took the full state pension, the new state pension, to £10,600. That is not a lot of money to be living on every year. So, you know, that's why those people need it. There is the issue where obviously this means that wealthy pensioners are getting 10.1% as well. But, you know, woe betide the person in their 30s and 40s who suggests that the pension rises should be means tested, because do you know what that means, don't you? That means by the time you get a pension, there'll be means testing the pension itself and you won't get one. So you've got to just look at this and go, well, look, they welched on it last year. They've done the right thing this year, and that will compound up over the years and should hopefully mean that you get more state pension in the years to come. Does mean that workers whose wages aren't going up by inflation are supporting pensioners who are getting their pensions going up by inflation. Benefits also gone up by inflation as well. Again, probably the right thing to do, because people who are living on benefits really don't have much money. There is the problem where you then get this middle ground, people who are just outside the benefit threshold and are really, really, really struggling, and they're not really getting the help, and actually they're now paying more tax as well. So there is an issue there. We got help on energy bills. I think the help on the energy bills was better than we thought it was going to be. There was a deep, deep concern that when Hunt said, right, you're not getting 2 years at £2,500 for the average household of an energy price cap. You're only getting till April, and then it's going to be targeted. We all thought targeted means you ain't getting
you
any
ain't
help,
getting
sunshine.
It.
Yeah. So capping it at £3,000 is another £500 on the average household's energy bill. And whilst there has been criticism that this subsidises wealthier households because they use more energy, it does in theory, but actually those wealthier households are paying much bigger energy bills as well. And it's not true to say that people are being supported to heat their swimming pools and things like that, because heating their swimming pool is costing them a small fortune. Yes, they are paying less than they would potentially pay to heat said swimming pool if the market was just allowed to run amok with energy prices, but they'd still be paying way, way more than other people if they wanted to heat their swimming pool. So I don't know. I think they had to do something, because the shock in energy bills is so great to people, and it's sucking such a large amount of money out of people's pockets every month, that maybe they had to do something to help. And I think that the idea of doing this for a year from April is that hopefully, actually, maybe sometime after April, energy prices might manage to come down below this energy price guarantee price cap level. And all of a sudden, the government doesn't have to keep stepping in on this. And you have to remember that sky high energy bills are not the result of normal people's behavior. It's not their fault that energy bills are so high. It is the fault of the catastrophic mismanagement of our energy system by the government over many, many years. The fact that we are producing more clean energy, yet paying dirty energy prices for it. And because Russia invaded Ukraine. Now, the average man or woman on the street is not responsible for any of those things. And they're told that they need to support Ukraine in the war against Russia. And they're told that somebody's going to do something about this clean energy pricing, but we're paying for dirty energy pricing. But we need clean energy because, you know, we've got to help the environment. And the government's holding its hands up and going, hey, it's not our fault. Like, we didn't plan ahead for any form of energy security. So I actually, you know, think people do deserve a little bit of help on this one.
Yeah. Well, yes, that was the good news. Now, for the bad news, Simon, you predicted as much last week when we did the podcast, the stealth and wealth statement. I mean, let's start with the tax thresholds. You went into quite a lot of detail last week, but they will be frozen until April 2028. Just briefly explain why that will mean millions more will pay tax.
Right.
Inheritance tax, income tax. Talk to us.
Stealth tax. Doesn't sound as bad, often much worse than a tax hike. In fact, actually, the effect of, sorry, just to get on my own hobby horse here, right? Okay. They've lowered the 45p rate of tax from kicking in at £150,000 to kicking in at £125,140. What a weird number.
It is a weird sort of figure. 125,140. Yeah, but it's a bit of an about turn. I mean, the average person might be forgiven for thinking, what? Only 55 days ago, the top rate was scrapped and now it's come down to this bizarre figure. What is the reasoning behind that? Do you know, Simon, why 125,140?
I do know exactly why. I also know why they've done this. It's gesture politics. It really is. It's this idea that they having seem to have stuffed up by so much, removing the 45p rate of tax, that they then needed to be seen to be punishing high earners. And so they've lowered it. So the broad shoulders idea. But it was a misnomer in the first place. Markets didn't have an issue with Kwasi Kwarteng's budget because he removed the 45p rate of tax. That wasn't the problem. That doesn't actually make that much difference. It's about £2 billion. And we were talking a much bigger number than that. It was tin-eared and it was daft because he managed to overshadow his own income tax cut for everyone to 19p. I mean, that behaviour in itself just must have made people go, I don't know if this guy should be in charge of the nation's finances because this is just silly, right? But it was not that much money. And even lowering it to £125,000 isn't going to pull in that much money either. It's just a gesture. But they've dropped it to 125,140 because that is the point at which people stop getting their personal allowance taken off them. So the personal allowance is £12,570. And if someone earns above £100,000, for every extra £1 that they earn, they have 50p of their personal allowance taken off them, until at £125,140, it is all gone. The effect of that is that their marginal tax rate is increased by 50%, by half, right? So instead of paying 40% tax on the next pound that they earn, they pay 60% tax. So Britain's tax rates actually go 20, 40, 60, 45 now, which I suppose is slightly more sensible than they used to be, 20, 40, 60, 40, 45. But it's still, this is a bugbear of mine, because I believe that you need to treat people fairly on their way up through the tax system in order to encourage them to keep paying substantial amounts of tax to support people who are not as well off as them. A similar thing happens with the child benefit. When child benefit's taken off parents, where if one parent earns more than £50,000. And again, that creates this problem. So that's why that limit is there, £125,140. The thresholds otherwise have been frozen. So the personal allowance has been frozen at £12,570. The higher rate tax threshold has been frozen at £50,270.
It was frozen anyway, 2026. They've just extended it to 2028, right?
Yep, they were frozen until 2026, which was already an unpopular stealthy move, and they have now been frozen until 2028. But an extra 2 years doesn't sound that bad. But when you look at the compounding effect of people's wages hopefully going up over those periods, it does drag an awful lot more people into the tax. And as an example of why this costs people so much money, I mean, firstly, you're dragging low earners into paying tax, which is the wrong thing to do. I think one of the best things that the Conservative government since Cameron has done, and this was largely under Cameron and Osborne, is really, really push up that personal allowance, the level at which you start to pay tax. And that's risen by more than inflation. The higher rate tax threshold hasn't risen by anywhere near as much as inflation. It should be about £60,000 if it had risen with inflation. It's still at £50,270. And the effect of that is that if you get an average pay rise, which at the moment is 5%, and you're right on the cusp of that, then your pay rise is worth about £2,500. If the higher rate tax threshold moves up in line with wages, right, which are the most basic level, you'd hope it would move up with wages, right? So people are actually genuinely getting a real increase or even inflation. But let's say it moves up with wages for simplicity's sake, then your full pay rise still gets taxed at 20%. So you only pay £500 worth of tax on your pay rise. If it's frozen as it is now, then you pay £1,000 worth of tax on your pay rise. And that's quite a big difference. It's twice as much tax, in fact. That's how the maths works. And so once you do that and you keep that in place for years after years after years, the effect compounds and compounds and compounds. And we have a tax system that is littered with thresholds that should have gone up over the years and haven't gone up over the years. And stealth tax doesn't sound as bad, can be just as bad, and comes under quite a lot of fire from very sensible commentators like the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which just says this is just the wrong and dishonest way to do things.
Yeah, but done it they have. You mentioned it earlier, tax-free allowances for dividend and capital gains tax also due to be cut next year and in 2024. So cuts, Simon, what's going on here?
Wow, I mean, kabam is all I can say on these two. There had been an expectation that capital gains tax might be equalized with income tax levels. So you could have seen people paying capital gains tax at 40p or 45p. So, you know, that, whereas currently, if you're, it's on shares or investments, it's 18p. And if it's on property, it's 28p. But you have a capital gains tax free allowance, which is £12,300. And the idea behind this is that if you're making a capital gain, you have taken some form of risk, be it investment risk, be it entrepreneurial risk, even the risk of being a buy-to-let landlord. And, you know, we do need them, as we talked about a couple of weeks back, because people do need homes to rent. And when the capital gains tax rates were lowered, it was done with the sort of swap for this old system of taper relief, where the longer you held onto an asset, the lower you could get the rate to go. So it was a sort of an exchange. It's like you can just have this permanently low flat rate, but you lose your taper relief. But the capital gains tax allowance has gone up over the years, not by a huge amount, but it has gone up. But it's chopped from 12,300 to 6,000 and then all the way down to £3,000. I mean, that is astonishing. That would have merited a place in the Jeremy Corbyn manifesto. It would have been. Dividends as well. Mm. Again, dividend tax rates were increased. They used to be much lower. And as a SOP, people got a £5,000 tax-free dividend allowance. Now, this was done in order to try to crack down a bit on people paying themselves as directors through limited companies and getting their money at dividend rates rather than income tax rates. But the collateral damage of this was small investors. But at least this £5,000 limit protected them. But then that was cut to £2,000. And then it's now going to be cut to £1,000 and then £500. And this, both of these things really do hit small investors. They hammer small investors, in fact, because yes, if you've got your money in an ISA or a pension, it's protected from these two things. But there are plenty of people out there who have built up pots over the years, ordinary savers and investors who've built up pots over the years that aren't within an ISA, that aren't within a pension, and they rely on them for income in later years to supplement their pension, or they're using them to, you know, to invest for their future. And they have been absolutely hammered by these measures.
All right, some other bad news, I guess, then. Local councils in England will be able to hike council tax up to 5% a year without a local vote instead of 3% currently. That stamp duty cut we got in the mini budget, that will go in 2025. Spending on public services in England will rise more slowly than planned, some departments facing cuts after the next election. And the one I wanted to talk to you about, Simon, to get your views, electric cars, vans and motorcycles to pay road tax from April 2025. The eyebrows just raised there, Simon. What do you make of that?
I mean, it was inevitable that this was going to happen at some point. We've got a road tax, vehicle excise duty system that currently has been zero rated for electric cars and has been for a while to try to encourage people to get electric cars. And actually there's other cars, very, very fuel efficient cars that were zero rated in the past as well, and some hybrids. But as more and more electric cars arrive on the roads, the government is going to start collecting less and less in VED, and it needs to fill that gap somehow. And you've also got to remember that, of course, the government isn't getting the same amount of tax on people charging electric cars as it is on people filling up with petrol. There's a huge tax saving there when you consider the amount that is fuel duty and VAT on petrol, whereas VAT on energy is lower. So this was always going to happen. I mean, ultimately, the end game here is probably some form of road pricing, but that would be hugely unpopular. And even Jeremy Hunt doesn't want to be that unpopular in one go.
Is it worth it? I know there's an environmental issue to it, but financially?
And actually, there's a bigger hit too as well from, if you're buying a new one, from the so-called showroom tax, which is that in the first few years of a car's life, you pay this extra road tax. And if you're buying a car that costs more than £40,000, our tax system is so daft. If you're buying a car that costs more than £40,000, you're seen as rich and therefore you're bad. Even though an electric car is a good thing, you still pay more on top in terms of this showroom tax. And people were looking there at basically about an extra £500 a year, £520 a year for 5 years on any electric car that costs more than £40,000. Cheapest Tesla is £48,500 at the moment. Electric cars are more expensive. That gap is narrowing. But, you know, I don't know. I think we're going, as more and more people buy electric cars, we're going to see the incentives to buy them taken away. That's inevitable because, you know, the government's bunging subsidies at rich people who can afford brand new cars.
All right. Look, Simon, this is a brief tour of the autumn statement, and I want you to sum up, if you would. We've gone through the goodish news, the bad news, the Resolution Foundation, as I said at the start, saying this is going to pile further pressure on the squeezed middle earners. But overall, will the country win from this in these dark economic times that we're living in?
Anybody who listens to this podcast recognize the fact that I am an eternal optimist. I'm always trying to see the glass half full thing. I'm always trying to paint a picture where somehow things work out better than they actually are. I would say that the idea of making sure that we are balancing the books is a good one, right? Mm. We can't just keep spending more than we have coming in. We do need to have some very honest conversations around exactly what we can afford in this country and how much we need to pay in order to get it. However, I think that where Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss swung way too far in one direction, Jeremy Hunt has swung way too far in the other. I cannot see a scenario where this kind of negative sentiment and tax hikes going into what has already been said is going to be a painful recession at the same time as people are seeing their household bills go up by hundreds of pounds a month, mortgages, food, energy bills. I can't see how this is a good idea and is not going to make the recession much worse. And Truss and Kwarteng were right. We do need growth. The best thing we can do is to get growth. The IFS said this today when they looked back at the last decade of the economy. It's like what's been missing is growth. I don't see how this is going to do anything other than hamper growth. And I don't see much in there to get growth going. I don't see the big conversations, the conversations around, right, so take, for example, the great idea of the Johnson government, levelling up. Okay. One of the greatest opportunities for levelling up that has been served up to us in the last couple of years was delivered by the shift to more online working from COVID, the realization that it's really important for people to be in an office together, right, and collaborating and creating and getting that buzz going, but they don't need to be there all the time. That maybe there's a pool of people, there's a pool of talent up north that could be employed by companies that are down south. And the fact that they're not moving to London doesn't matter. By all means, get them down to London every so often. Get those people together. Get the people from London up to the north. However you want to do this creatively, right? There was a real opportunity there to increase our productivity. And we've got a problem with productivity in this country. And what did we get instead? We got Jacob Rees-Mogg wandering around leaving notes on people's desks, asking where they were. This is not seizing an opportunity when it's presented to you. This is looking at the opportunity and then slamming the door in its face. Now, things have changed since then. You know, we've got a new prime minister. He's not elected, but, you know, he is a new prime minister. Maybe we could have had some slightly different thinking. I don't see anything in Jeremy Hunt's mini budget yesterday about any of these new ideas for growth. And well, I was saying earlier about this social tax contract, all I see that's going on here, and bear in mind, right, I'm talking about this from a privileged position. I know lots of people in privileged positions. They've got good jobs. They earn decent money. But when you talk to those people, all they're complaining about is being taxed. You get a pay rise, gets taken away in tax, all this kind of stuff. They're working really hard. They pay lots of tax and they see public services going downhill. I mean, our public services are shocking in many ways. We've cut stuff, you know, to the bone. We're delivering people quite a bad service on many things. And you need to convince those people who are further up the scale that they do need to be contributing tax because they're lucky, because they earn more, because, you know, yes, it might feel like they're paying lots of tax, but look at all the money that they're keeping and that they need to help support the less fortunate in society and that the welfare state is there to help people so that they don't fall through the cracks and then pull them back up. You know, and that actually there are people who are falling outside of those benefits and are really, really struggling. How do we go and help those? And I don't see any of that going on. I see the gap getting bigger and bigger, and I see an even greater polarization between the people who are paying a lot of the tax and the people that they see as getting lots of the benefit and the people at the bottom who are really, really struggling and looking at the people at the top and going, they're rich and they've got loads of money and this isn't fair. And I just don't think that we are solving the problems that we need to solve. And I don't think that this mini budget has done really very much to do it. And to end on my normal note of optimism, mm-hmm. I genuinely think, though, that all of these forecasts might be way too pessimistic. I honestly think that the potentially the economy is much more resilient than we think. We do have quite a lot of people in this country with quite a lot of money who still have plenty to spend. If you head out there, there's still people out there. They're eating out, they're drinking out, spending money, they're buying presents, they're going on holidays, they're doing all these things. And I think that we proved that we were far more resilient through COVID and the lockdowns, which were a huge shock, the shock of our lifetimes to our way of living and what we were doing and to our economy. And if we could do that, we could do it again. So I actually think that the forecasts are way too pessimistic and hopefully we'll be fine. But I do genuinely think that we need a much, much, much better plan for the future than just serving up half-baked one after half-baked one after half-baked one.
Well, there you have it. Final word to you, Simon. You sort of could have ended it there positively, but then you just dragged it a little bit back a bit. But that's fine. No worries. That's it for this week. Let's see what next week brings. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and find all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.